Hi there, Gemma here. If you're enjoying our podcast, then please do come along and put your name down on the wait list for our Schema Circle. And that way you'll hear when we next open the doors for new members to join. The Schema Circle is really our passion project, and it's our online schema coaching membership program. There's nothing really quite like it. It's new and innovative, and we just love it. Now, there's a huge library of content waiting for you already inside. We also continue to do 3 live Q&A coaching calls every month. Now, everything is recorded, of course, and ready for you to view at your own pace. If you're looking for, a unique way to understand yourself better and to make real change, then I do invite you to come and have a look. Go to theredflagproject.com.au/SC. Now, the Schema Circle isn't therapy, but it's a great accompaniment to your own therapy journey. It's also a great resource for therapists and coaches and for anybody, men and women, wanting to know more about schemas and how we can use this fantastic model to empower ourselves to make actual changes, the changes we want in our life. Now, it's currently housed on our Red Flag website, and just click the link below to read all about it. I hope to see you inside one day. Thanks for joining us at the Good Mood Clinic podcast, where we get to the heart of the matter about what makes us humans tick. We're Justine Corrie and Gemma Gladstone, 2 clinical psychologists and schema therapists, and we're passionate about helping you break unwanted life patterns and finding new ways to understand yourself and those tricky people around you. Life is way too short to be derailed by our schemas, by self-sabotage, toxic relationships, or a lack of self-worth. So let's tackle this together and help you reclaim your life and who you really are. Hello, welcome to today's episode. My name's Gemma Gladstone. And before we get into today's episode, I just wanted to preface it by saying a little bit more about narcissism. So in this episode, it's a mailbox episode, Justine and I address 2 questions and issues that 2 of our listeners submitted. The first one is got to do with what happens when you're co-parenting your children, even children that are a little bit older, teenagers, when your ex-partner is narcissistic. We talk about that, as well as another question from a listener on a completely different topic to do with supporting your partner while they have schema therapy. So getting back to co-parenting with a narcissist, this is a really tricky subject and can be absolutely incredibly difficult for the person who's trying to survive, raise their kids, and manage their difficult partner, who is now their ex, in bringing up their children. And narcissism is a really complicated topic. For further information, I ask you to go back and listen to episodes 14, 17, 20, and 22. There we go into a lot of detail about understanding narcissism and dealing with the narcissist in your life, including how we manage narcissistic parents, but more from an adult perspective. That is, when you're an adult, how do you deal with your narcissistic parent? So we go into a great bit of detail about that. In today's question, a man asked about how he manages raising his daughters who are now in their teens and how he manages them to protect them from the negative influences of an ex-partner who, his therapist says, is narcissistic. Of course, we don't fully know that because we don't know the whole situation, of course, but we're trusting that this person feels that they're in a relationship or ex-partner is a narcissist and that their therapist has pointed this out. So I just wanted to provide a caveat. When we talk about these issues, obviously, it's really difficult to know exactly where to pitch our responses because narcissism falls on a continuum. There's a dimensional view, just like any other personality trait or type. We go from having mild traits right up to full and extensive traits into the category or area of a personality disorder. And narcissism is no different. We can have some traits of narcissism right up to being a very, very toxic and pathological or malignant narcissist. And of course, who knows where someone falls on that spectrum if we don't have all the information. So just be mindful that when we're talking about narcissism, it does fall on a spectrum. Some people who have narcissistic traits also have some degree of healthy capacity. They might have a capacity to hear you, to hear feedback. You may be able to talk to them rationally in their healthier moments. Whereas other narcissists, people who are more extreme, may qualify for the disorder or just have very high traits, may be a lot more difficult to deal with. And this is the very pointy end of the spectrum, and it's very, very hard to co-parent if your ex-partner is falling into this category. So some of the advice that we give our listener may or may not be applicable to you, to your narcissist that you're dealing with, because every case is going to be super different and have its own level of difficulty. So some narcissists are never going to be able to tolerate, many people high on the spectrum will never tolerate you trying to get them to understand you, right? Telling them that you feel hurt by what they say, or trying to appeal to them being an empathic person. It's not going to work because they don't have the capacity. They don't see you as someone who has their own thoughts and feelings. They may be completely have huge deficits in empathy. They may not be able to tolerate your subjectivity. And so they're never going to hear you. And so particularly toxic narcissists are a completely different kettle of fish to people that have a couple of narcissistic traits but an otherwise healthier core. Narcissists who don't have a healthy core are probably very self-emotionally deprived on the inside, but they've got huge levels of self-absorption, and their shame always gets in the way of them ever being able to hear you. Okay, so these are people that you're not going to be able to rationalize with at all, and you're never going to be able to probably have healthy conversations, and they will never get you, and they'll never hear your point of view, and they can't step outside their shoes and into your own. And sadly, this is some people, and sadly, these are some parents. So if you're dealing with those kinds of people, our advice is never that, you know, you're going to encourage your children to have a heart-to-heart with these people and try to get them understood, because perhaps this parent just doesn't have the capacity for that. They're so self-absorbed and so toxic, that's never kind of going to work. They're never going to hear you. And sadly, some people are like that. And that's when you nearly need to have tailored professional advice, get support from other people, whether it be other healthy family members or a professional, so that they can give you tailored advice in terms of dealing with a particular narcissist in your life, particularly if you're in a co-parenting situation. We're going to add some extra links at the bottom of this episode, some reading material and some websites, so you can check those out. So I hope you enjoy the episode. And if you're dealing with a very toxic personality in a co-parenting situation, we feel for you. I'm sure you're doing a good job trying to deal with this. It's not an easy topic. Hope you enjoy the episode. Hello and welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Good Mood Clinic podcast. My name's Gemma Gladstone. I'm here with my colleague and co-host, Justine Corey. How are you, Justine?
I'm really well, Jim.
Ending of the school holidays or still on school holidays?
I'm still on school holidays. I'm in the middle of them, so I've got one more week. It's a beautiful day today and summer's coming, which is always really nice.
It's lovely in Sydney, beautiful Sydney weather. Sorry if you're not having awesome weather, but we can get out and go on those picnics because we're having this great weather.
Yeah, the big blue sky.
And for those of you who don't know us, we started this podcast back in June last year, sort of in response to lockdown and the pandemic, as a way of connecting with our clients and just to put out some positive messages about mental health and how there's always something that you can do And we love talking about schema therapy. We're both schema therapists here based in Sydney. We've both been in practice for quite a long time. So we've got lots of experience. We've got a background in mental health and research. And we came into therapy and we've got quite a few years of therapy experience. We just are very passionate about helping people realize that there's always something you can do. And we're interested in getting to the crux of the issue or the underlying issue. That's why we're both passionate about schema therapy, because it helps us look at vulnerabilities. And if we do the work, the psychological work, we can reduce sort of episodes of things like depression and anxiety and just live sort of a better kind of quality of life. What do you think?
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. Yeah, what we love about schema therapy is that if you address your schemas, it impacts positively on everything, on your relationships, how you feel about yourself, what you feel you can do. So it's sort of a really good way to get to those underlying issues without having to address all the problems in a top-down fashion.
And you move away from sort of, sometimes it's not necessarily that great to receive a label or a diagnostic label. And when you're sort of looking at the ground-up approach and looking at what makes us tick, what are our schemas, what are our psychological vulnerabilities, we can improve our resilience and just learn a little bit more about ourselves and other people. So we've been covering all sorts of different topics, haven't we, from relationships. We've spoken quite a bit about narcissism. We've spoken about some other mental health issues. We've spoken about, what else, depression, online stuff. We've sort of covered lots of different areas. We've spoken a lot about the Red Flag Project that we're involved in, our course. It's sort of a vast array of topics we've been covering. And then we've asked for people to send us in some comments and questions, and we've had quite a lot of those. So today we're going to look at two. Today is back to the mailbox and with episode 37. So we've got two questions, comments that people have written into us, and we're going to address those today. We'll go one at a time. And the first one is from someone called Joe, not his real name. And Justine, you're going to briefly, are we going to read out his email and summarize his answer?
Joe he's got a problem with a narcissist in his life, and sounds like it's the mother of his girls. So I'll just read out the whole thing. Yeah. So I just wanted to drop your line to thank you for the work on the podcast. Thanks, Joe. My therapist suggested I listen to the podcast after she floated the idea that my ex-wife and mother were narcissists. Okay, so he's got two narcissists. I was very insecure, as I feared she was softly trying to infer that I was the narcissist. And luckily, after a couple of sessions, we worked through that and it gave me the confidence to have a listen. I must admit, even when I was listening to it, I keep asking myself, am I like that too? It's always a fear, isn't it, of people? Yeah. My goodness, am I like her or him? And he really liked our gaslighting episode. I said, heard the term before, but had no idea what it meant. That was when we did that. Great. We did that role play. That was quite fun. Anyway, the reason for my writing was something that I'm struggling with, and maybe some of your clients are too, and it could be content for an episode. So you're right, Joe, this is something other people do struggle with. So he has two daughters.
Yeah. Well, we won't say the age of them. We'll just say they're teenagers.
Yeah. So he has two daughters in custody. Yeah, they're teenagers, 50-50. And he wants to know how to help them to deal with their mother, who he thinks is narcissistic. So what can I do to help them when they're facing the issues of having a narcissistic mother without putting ideas in their head? So obviously he doesn't want to undermine their relationship with their mum in any way, but also he wants to help his girls grow up without being impacted from the behaviour their mother might be doing in her relationship with his girls. Very tricky.
It's a tricky one, and that co-parenting with someone who's narcissistic is really tough.
Yeah. But what I really like about what Joe's saying is he's aware that he has to try and preserve the relationship they have with her, you know, because he's really aware of that, which is good. So he's really thinking about their interests. So that's really nice. Yes. But, yeah, I totally get why that's important to you, Joe, because you probably see it from the outside looking in and probably seeing things that are stressful or making, you know, sad, seeing what they're coping with.
So is part of his question, how does he, assuming that he's not, doesn't have these similar qualities, how does he provide a buffer or the emotional support or the care for his girls, his teens? How does he do that when he has the kids?
Sounds like, and maybe just I don't know, like, you know, I can imagine, like, I'm in a shared care situation myself. And, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes kids come home and they'll tell you things that, about what would happen at the other house. And internally you're going, oh, gosh, you know, okay, that wasn't a great parenting moment. But then you you can't necessarily throw your co-parent under the bus with the kids because that's so good for them. So I'm thinking maybe that's what's going on. He's hearing things maybe from his girls and is worried about them. That's what I assumed.
Yeah. So there's the issue of kind of sort of him concentrating on his own relationship with his girls and how he can really make that as solid and as positive and as healthy and as nurturing as he possibly can.
Yeah.
Because you can only do what you can do, Joe, in terms of that. So in terms of your relationship with your girls, you need to be able to be really available, really emotionally available, listen to them, resist the urge to always find, you know, solutions first off. So these are kids that are a bit older. So a lot of things have, there's been a lot of water under the bridge by the sounds of things. But it's never too late to try different ways of communicating with kids. So like you said yesterday, you know, not leaving a kid alone with big emotions and being there for them. So, you know, doing a lot of that emotion coaching.
Yeah, really important.
Because your relationship with them is very important. Even though they're teenagers, it's still very important and you can still make a huge positive impact by some changes. And the changes I would be mentioning would be just being aware that when they do come to you with their problems, you're open, you listen, you just validate the difficulty, like validate their emotional worlds and validate what they're actually going through, and then help them come to a solution, work with them at that point, but make sure you sort of validate and normalize what they're feeling. It's really important.
Yeah, so yeah, the whole emotion coaching thing is really important because kids, I mean, I suppose this is kind of an implicit problem solving, isn't it? It's just you making sure that you're giving them an experience that might be different to what they're getting from a parent who's narcissistic. So if we know, you know, parents who are narcissistic, they can't validate, they can't see the child's perspective, they can't do repairs, you know, so they can't say sorry when they make mistakes, they tend to blame the child. So I suppose, Joe, you're doing everything, you know, that you can do to be the opposite of that. So to be a safe space for them to come and talk to you about all sorts of things. And that's where the emotion coaching comes in. And that's you implicitly modeling, giving them a different model of a relationship that is different perhaps to what they're getting with their mum. And so maybe we can post a link to the emotion coaching, the Gottmans, maybe in the show notes, Jim. So you can, if you investigate that and go down that path, Joe, at least you know you're doing the best practice, like you're doing everything you can do.
Yeah.
And kids appreciate it. You may, if you can do it already, you may get teenagers going, oh, Dad, what are you, what? Suddenly start being more curious about their feelings. You know, they may notice the difference, but that's okay. Just persist because deep down it actually feels really, really good. So, you know, they might find it a bit unfamiliar initially if they're not used to it, but don't worry, just keep going.
Yeah, and also to take care of yourself, Joe, because, you know, you mentioned that your mother may have these qualities as well. Your mother might be narcissistic. So, you know, when you're having these difficulties with your ex, it might really kind of be triggering in that way. That might be sort of differentiating between your pain and your discomfort, what's going on for you, your anger, your annoyance, your frustration, and then the girls will have a different experience. Your experience is going to be different from your girls. They're going to have their own experience. And so that's why it's so important for you to give them a different experience as much as possible that you had with your mother.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's where the emotion coaching is important too, because when you emotion coach, you are less likely to jump to conclusions because you're giving the child their space to actually tell you all about their experience. So you may hear things in those types of conversations that are actually quite reassuring to you about how they're thinking about some of their mum's behaviour. So you may not actually have to jump in and do anything. They may already be coming to some of their own conclusions about it. And then you can just obviously be there and validate. Whereas if you don't have that curiosity, you may be projecting some of your own stuff inadvertently onto them, which may feel like it's more of an emergency, whereas it may not be. So I think that's a good thing to remember. Another reason why it's important to do the emotion coaching.
And to get your own support, you know, around it, maybe your own therapy if that's something that you haven't had or you need to do. Oh, you're getting your own therapy because your therapist has flagged the idea that you have narcissists in your life.
Maybe we can touch on a more, this is probably one of the more difficult scenarios, is when your child comes home, as I, you know, just mentioned before, and actually has a distressing story about some interaction or something that's happened at the other house. That's really tough. What do you do then? I think that's probably maybe what he's...
It depends on what it is, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
How much of this, is it something that you need to just be with your daughters and do the emotion coaching and hear their story and validate and know that you've got their back? Is it more about that? Or is it really something very significant where you'd have to intervene, get some help or intervene in terms of actually addressing your ex and telling them that this is something you're very unhappy with, or telling them the impact that it's having and that you're keeping a close eye on it? You know, what do you think? It depends how difficult the other person is that you're dealing with, how narcissistic they are. They, you know, how many difficult modes do they have? Are they ever able to have a bit of insight and reflect and say, you know, so some narcissists have the capacity to do that. They can have some empathy when they're in their better moments. They will say, oh yeah. So it's more of a mode thing. They'll get angry or they'll get critical or they'll get caught up in their own self-absorption or become a martyr. But then they also have some capacity for healthy adult space and they can hear a bit and others can't. Others are never going to have that point of separation. They don't ever see your subjectivity and they can't ever hear your point of view. So it really depends on how severe this woman's narcissism actually is.
That's right. And yeah, we don't know that obviously. Yeah. So I suppose you may say there's two points. One is actually, do you have to go and talk to the other parent about the incident? Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. And then depends on how, you know, what you're dealing with the ex. But then I suppose in terms of actually how you might coach your children through that particular scenario without throwing your ex under the bus, you know, because that would be really, you know, hard for the kids to hear. And I think obviously my children are all about schemas and modes, obviously.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think children, particularly the age of yours, would kind of understand that we all, you know, you could help them understand we all have vulnerabilities and different parts of ourselves, and that, you know, you've got them and your mum's got them and they've got them too. And so if you can help them understand perhaps some of the dynamics that are going on, you know, then they, because the thing is with these incidents with a narcissistic parent is you don't want them to blame themselves and internalize any sort of shame or guilt that they're the problem. Yeah. That's sort of the key thing you're trying to address. So if you can just help them see it as, you know, like it's part of her, and, you know, that's just one part of her and this is something she finds hard. And then if you're also talking about your own vulnerabilities in general with them when you're parenting them, and you're also doing repairs when you make mistakes, that's going to help them understand relationships in a whole different way and give them a framework for understanding perhaps what's going on without necessarily compromising that relationship with their mum. It's just normalizing the fact that we all have these difficult parts. So that's something you could do if you felt you wanted to explore schemas more in yourself, because obviously you'd have to do that from your own perspective. You couldn't just be talking about her schemas and not yours.
Everybody's really, you have to.
Everybody's, yes.
Yeah, you know, just begin to bring that language into the house and your relationship with them. And, you know, maybe talk about, you know, what the schemas are and that we all have parts of ourselves and sometimes we flip into these parts and it's a good idea to kind of name them. And also, I suppose, you know, talk about boundaries as well. You know, it coming back to, you know, how difficult mum is, some things are okay and some things are not okay. And it's okay to have a point of differentiation and say, you know, mum, when you speak to me like that, it really hurts my feelings and I just want to get some space away from you. Maybe possible to say things like that to your parent. You know, again, it depends on, these are sort of young teenagers. So perhaps the older one, there's a little bit of scope for even that. So we want to be able to teach the girls that, you know, okay, it's okay to have a boundary and to set a limit with people sometimes, even if it is your mother. And particularly if she does say particularly critical or hurtful things, yes, you can say to yourself, that's her and that's a mode she's in. And it's also okay to say, you know what, I think I need a bit of space. I'm going to go into the
I'm going to go for a walk, or I'm going to, you know, organize to go for a friend's and see if that's possible, or get some space in any other way possible.
And what do you think? I mean, again,
not always easy, but
it's really hard with a mother but in some at some level, your girls will have to learn to do this anyway to move away from the impact this relationship has on them. And it's actually a very powerful thing when you can give your child a framework to understand what's going on in that way. So, yeah, I mean, because boundaries get crossed all the time and those, you know, if your parent's narcissistic. So even them hearing that that could be an option would be really powerful.
Just an idea, I suppose, yeah, because we don't want to collude and surrender and become completely hopeless. And it depends on that and convey that to the children. It depends on the age of the child, but just coaching them a little bit, just to have a little bit of a clear, or even a comment to say, hey, there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, mum, when you say that to me, I actually feel really hurt. You know, that's a really mean thing to say, or, you know, that's really hurtful to say that in the moment, depending on the child and if they're able to do that.
Yeah, so they may or may not be able to do that, but it's a very powerful thing just to even be able to entertain you could. And then
that you're allowed to.
That's right.
You're allowed to.
And then obviously in your relationship with them, you should be encouraging that too. So if you, you know, have a bad moment, as we all do with parents, you know, letting your girls know that it's okay for them to tell them, the, you know, have that boundary with you and to say how they feel and for you to be okay with that. So really giving them that experience in their relationship with you.
It's a revolutionary way of parenting to be able to let your children have their own space and to not feel like everything is so personal coming from them, but to be able to see them as these separate beings and separate little creatures that actually are entitled to have that point of differentiation, to have their own space. It takes a lot of personal reflection and development often.
Yeah, but very, very powerful and very worthwhile.
Look, just that it's hard. I think there's a fair bit of writing on this. I think that narcissism and relationships is an area that a lot of people have written on. So there's a fair amount of resources out there. We'll link some books that we have on the topic of narcissism to this episode. And a number of different persons. Wendy Bahari's written on it, and Nina Brown has written on it. And so there's a number of people who have written about this topic.
Yeah, I wonder if there's any, you know, giving your children a knowledge of schemas and that framework. I haven't come across anything on that.
Specifically?
Yeah, that type of parenting strategy in the situation. I don't think I have.
Yeah, I'm not sure specifically.
No, yeah.
There's certainly people who have schema therapy for children and adolescents and so forth.
But
in terms of specifically giving them skills and coaching around how to deal with the parent, it's very similar when we talk about, you know, how you deal, except there's less freedoms and less autonomy, of course. And it's a spectrum of how dependent the child is on a parent. If the child is very dependent on the parent and very young, then we have very little control over what's going on. And the older we get and the more dependence, you know, we have for ourselves, less dependent we are on the parent, then we can have that. There's bigger scope for us to have our own boundaries. That what you said before about letting them know that this is mum's stuff, and so that they don't internalize it, which is
very powerful.
But of course, when it's coming from your mother, it's hard not to internalize it.
Oh, totally. It's painful. It must be painful to watch, Joe.
But to let them know that, you know, they're good kids, and to do a lot of encouraging and identifying their strengths where you can, and just all that emotion coaching type stuff to do. So we'll put the link in there for resources on that. But that's a great parenting method that we use ourselves and that we teach our clients, and we can incorporate that with schema. And it's a great method to have in adult relationships, you know, intimate relationships, emotion coaching. So, yeah, good. So I hope that's been helpful. So we've probably covered the most of that. Let's have just a short break and with a bit of a message from us, and then we'll come back and talk about our next question.
Are you a woman currently going through a breakup? Is the pain of the breakup interfering with your ability to live your best life? If this is you, then you'll want to get a copy of Justine and Gemma's Breakup Guide. The Red Flag Project Breakup Guide will provide you with the practical advice and psychological support you'll need as you navigate the emotional ups and downs of a breakup. Taking care of yourself and your future self will be much easier with the support you'll get from this step-by-step companion resource. You'll find a link in the show notes, which will take you straight to the breakup guide for more information. Or you can go to goodmoodclinic.com.au/RFP-BUG. That's goodmoodclinic.com.au/RFP-BUG.
Hello, lovely listeners. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. It's Gemma Gladstone here, and I want to let you know a little bit more about the Red Flag Project. It's an online course for women which provides you with a dating strategy designed to help you understand why you've ended up in relationships with men who have been emotionally unavailable or narcissistic. In the course, we'll help you begin to break this pattern and to really understand what's going on underneath it all. We'll teach you about all the actual red flags to watch out for and give you lots of practical advice and strategies. It will be life-changing if you let it. Just click on The Red Flag Project in the show notes below for this episode to get all the info. Now let's get back to the show. Okay, so we're back and we're going to talk about a question that Karen, not her real name, has written in. Now, this is one we hear about quite a bit as well. I'm just going to summarize it for you. So Karen's partner is actually doing some schema therapy with a therapist. Oh. She mentions that he's doing some therapy and particularly focusing on his emotional deprivation schema and his self-sacrifice schema. She says that he copes with this, with his schemas in general, I guess, by pushing her away, perhaps keeping her at a distance. And her question is, how do you help someone or really be in a relationship with someone who's learning about their schemas and perhaps these two in particular and how they influence his life and how what he's like in relationships? How do you help and how do you cope with it?
Good question. What are his two schemas, emotional deprivation and self-sacrifice? Okay.
And I'm sure he has more, just like all rest of us.
Yes.
And Karen's a good idea to check out your own.
That's right. So assuming Karen probably has some ideas and insights about schemas already, shall we assume that? Because that would be your first port of call, obviously, to kind of realise what's being triggered in you when he goes into his schema-driven coping modes or coping styles and to address that in yourself so you don't make it worse inadvertently. That would be the first port of call.
To look at the interaction, what's happening in his, particularly his, well, they're quite different schemas. I mean, but one, the emotional deprivation schema is one of the really core schemas. And then we often think about the self-sacrifice schema as being sort of an adaptive schema, a conditional schema that comes out of unmet needs around the air, or it can be straight learned from early childhood and modeled, but it's also one that we acquire as a way of getting our needs met. If I self-sacrifice, if I put other people first, if I follow the guilt feeling and do for others but don't sort of do for myself, then perhaps I won't risk a relationship and I'll stay closer to people. So it serves a functional role often, the self-sacrifice schema in that regard. But if we just look at the ones one at a time, so emotional deprivation, if he's got a strong emotional deprivation schema in a relationship, what's that partner going to look like?
Well, if he's in the pushing away mode, and that in terms of what she's described, so imagine just sort of very shut down and hard to connect with.
Yeah.
You know, probably doing a bit of stonewalling and feeling very vulnerable inside, but you wouldn't see that. You'd probably see someone who looked a bit impassive and like maybe didn't care very much, probably avoiding you, which isn't nice.
Yeah. I mean, this is very stereotypical.
Yes.
Live in the world of stereotypes in terms of psychology and therapy. But, you know, often guys, men with a emotional deprivation schema. It's a very common one for them. There's a lot of intergenerational father emotional deprivation. So, you know, they don't have great role models in terms of that either. So it's very typical for men to describe their fathers as being very not so available, not emotionally available, closed off, going into the cave, etc., not really being there emotionally. So they're kind of not really given a great start. And then if they're parented in a way where they haven't been emotionally attuned to, sort of seen and recognized, there's not a lot of space for emotions, then they don't really know how else to interact. And so they might want to be close. They might want to be connected, but they're just, it's unfamiliar territory. It's unfamiliar territory to go into an emotionally vulnerable space, and that's really hard.
Yeah, and they can have a lot of sort of secondary shame about needing as well, can't they? So that's also pushes them away, makes them want to retreat and hide. So there's probably a lot going on for him, but he looks impenetrable from your perspective. I think, well, there's two things. One is actually what you do when he's in the middle of a trigger and how you're regulating yourself to not make it worse. But then there's also what you do when he's not in a trigger and maybe he's back in his sort of integrated, healthy adult mode self, and you two can talk about it, I suppose, isn't it? There's probably, often this comes up in therapy for people because their partner may not be ready for couples therapy or be willing to go there. And so it's sort of like you regulating yourself so at least you don't make it worse. So I think the problem when your partner goes into that mode, and let's just say you've got your own attachment, which is a bit insecure, or you've got your abandonment schema around emotional deprivation, it can feel like a real emergency to reconnect with them again in that moment.
Yeah. So there's a lot of moving toward, there's a lot of anxious mood, like what's wrong? Open up. Where are you going?
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. And so there's a lot of anxious moving towards, and then he's just going, oh my gosh.
Yeah. That's the last thing. Yes. Anger, you get angry. Yeah. You can go into an angry child mode because you're being rejected, and so that can fly out, which obviously would make it worse, trigger more shame for him.
Yes. So what triggers you when he's sort of closed off in that way, you know?
Yeah.
And how do you are able to soothe yourself in the moment and deal in other ways rather than getting that immediate connection from him?
That's right.
Because that's very painful.
Tough. Very painful, yeah. So the first thing I'd say, okay, this is not an emergency. Sounds like this is a pattern. You know how this rolls. You're obviously still together after this being your loop. I say every couple has a loop. This is yours with him, schema-driven loop. So we first to say this is not an emergency, and then I suppose regulate those emotions in yourself, whatever you've got going on, whether it's the anger or an abandoned feeling or that horrible disconnected lonely feeling. You do what you need to do to calm down and actually give him his space, to be honest. Mm. Just let him go off into his ice tower for a bit and wait for him to integrate.
That's what I call it,
the ice tower.
Ice tower.
Ice tower.
Wait for him to thaw out.
Yeah. I'm assuming he does because you're still together. The Gottmans will call it stonewalling. And then hopefully you can call on maybe the support of a friend, or you can go and do your own journaling, or you can just get out of the house and have a break, whatever you need to do to feel soothed in yourself, not rely on him because he can't do that for you in that moment. Mm-hmm. And then when he can reconnect, talk to him about what he was feeling, what that was like for you, and come up with a bit of a plan together.
In your more rational, calm-minded moments, coming up with a bit of a plan together would be a good idea.
Yeah.
To say, you know, in the heat of the moment when we both get triggered and he wants to retreat because he's too overwhelmed or finding something very difficult and that triggers you, to be able to discuss, okay, what do you each need in these times? And sometimes it's useful for the partner who's doing the retreating to be coached a little bit, just to say, look, I love you and care about you, but right now I'm overwhelmed and I need to do X, Y, and Z. So particularly if you've got an abandonment schema, you might need to hear that from your partner. Hey, this is not me rejecting you, but it's me needing to just get that little bit of space. So because what would be destructive is if you kept at him in those moments. So you could come back and say something like, I care about you, I love you, and you can have your space. So maybe they just need to say, reiterate the connection that they have before they each get what they need.
You mean to, when they move away from each other?
Yeah, I mean, before you move away, if you're able to just say, this is how I'm feeling, I'm still in this relationship, but I need this, and the other person to say, yes, this is, I'm still care about you, and I'm going to give you the space, kind of thing.
Yeah, that would be something good to aim for sure, because, I mean, that does require an integration in that moment, you guys coming out of your child modes and out of your coping modes and be able to articulate that.
But if you have that as, I'm not saying that you would suddenly say that in the moment unless you have already discussed it. So if I was working with this person, like it, hypothetically as a couple, I would make sure that they have those solutions so that when they're next triggered in that interaction, they can say that. I'm not leaving you. I just need my space. Mm. I love you and care about you, but I need to go for a walk and cool down, whatever it is, before you leave, before you exit.
Yeah, or even a text message or something. I guess it's so,
whatever it is.
Just communicating something.
Because I don't know what your schemas are, Karen, but I'm guessing if you're in a relationship with a guy who's got a very strong emotional deprivation schema, you've probably got either one yourself or a heavy dose of abandonment. That probably is triggering you when he shuts down in that in that way. So you probably need to get a system for each other. How do you communicate that you're still connected, but he actually needs distance at this time? How do you do that? So having those conversations in your cooler moments would be a good idea. And just also, she says, how do I do cope with that? When you notice him being or opening up, say, like acting in opposition to his emotional deprivation schema in relationships, maybe he does open up, or maybe he shows vulnerability, or maybe he is curious about your emotions, or maybe he's talking about his own, just a little bit of positive reinforcement wouldn't go astray. A little bit of encouragement.
That's a good idea.
Not like signposting it and say, you opened up, great, let's have a party, but just a little bit like, oh, that's really nice. I felt really connected to you when we spoke about that.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And then that will make him feel safer because he's heard you say that.
Explicitly.
And he'll feel less shame about it because it's like, oh, okay, it was well received. And because often some people hold back because they feel like things are going to be used against them later on. But that's a different dynamic, but depending on what they've had.
Yeah, they don't trust that if they're vulnerable, it won't come back to bite them.
That's right. There's a mistrust around that. Yeah, emotional deprivation schemas can be very pervasive. They can be very strong. They're very common. But, you know, you can work on them. You can shift them.
And if you're still together, there's obviously lots of positive things about the relationship. And I think while you could really grow as a couple if you're working through this together. No, relationships can be very healing for schemas, but as long as you're talking about them. So, I mean, these schema-driven loops that you're in, as I said, you know, every couple has one. It's your own unique one. You know how it rolls. And so just because you know what it is, though, doesn't mean you don't keep talking about it. So each time you have a trigger, you have to kind of reconnect again and repair, reflect on what happened, and that's what actually reduces the likelihood of it happening again. So sometimes the repetition, like one partner may have a resistance to keep discussing it because it seems like it's old ground, but it's not the content. It's actually that process of reconnection and repair that makes the relationship safe again, and then you can move forward. And then it'll happen again because that's just, you know, that's part of change. You kind of have to keep trying. But that actually, that reconnection, even though it's on repeat, is really, really important. So just to reinforce that too. And also not to get, you know, angry and resentful if your partner can't do the connected disconnection, you know, if you like, because sometimes you're just so flooded, that's just not possible. But as long as you're coming back and doing the repair and you're aiming for that, that's good. That's all you can ask for. And then that will really add to the trust and more emotional intimacy in your relationship. Because you're coaching each other through it.
Yeah, because sort of sweeping it under the carpet and never speaking it again about it again is tempting in the moment because you don't want to, but it's not.
I just had a thought as well. Like the worst thing you can do as well is use your knowledge of your partner's schemas against them.
Uh-huh.
For example, have you heard about that?
And, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I do it all the time. No.
Yeah. You said your emotional deprivation schema was better and now it's not and you're never going to get over it. That type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Try not to bring your arguments, but it just erodes the trust and sort of it erodes the effectiveness of bringing that perspective into your discussions if your partner feels it's going to get thrown back at them.
Yeah, and like we were saying before, don't ever use things and throw things back in people's face that they've said when they've been vulnerable or honest or real, because that will be a killer of your relationship.
Yes.
That will be beyond the...
That kills love.
Beyond the level that you might be able to salvage it. Okay. And so what about his other schema, self-sacrifice schema?
So I suppose depends how that's manifesting. It's his surrendering. Yeah, or avoiding or overcompensating.
Yeah. Interesting observation with the self-sacrifice schema when you're in a relationship. Say you're in a relationship with someone who is a surrendering self-sacrificer. In other words, they feel the urge to self-sacrifice and they do it. They act on the urge to self-sacrifice because their guilt is too strong. And they feel too bad if they don't. So they're doing this for someone and then they're doing that for someone else and then they're doing five other things for someone else, and they're always caught up in this kind of cycle of perhaps pleasing people and helping others and this, that, and the other. Often what I've noticed is that the family of the self-sacrificer gets subsumed into that dynamic. The self-sacrificer self-sacrifices to all these other people, but often doesn't to the actual partner.
So they're meant to be the ones they don't have to worry about.
Yeah, don't have to worry about you.
Yeah.
And they kind of see it as an extension of themselves. And this is where the self-sacrifice schema can sometimes be quite self, it can be very self-absorbed in that sense, and that you're getting your needs met through helping others and rescuing others, and it can tip over into extreme martyr form manifestation. But sometimes we're doing it because we want to feel important. We want to feel needed. We want to feel like we are the one to rescue hundreds of people, and our immediate family members can suffer from that. So I've seen that dynamic quite a bit. Have you seen that one?
Totally. Yeah, that point you made about it's like their needs, they assume you have the same needs, i.e. none, in moments, and so that they're off helping everyone else and you're like, hello.
Hello, why did you volunteer to do that? We actually decided that we were going to have dinner.
Yeah.
Or, you know, what about us?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's really hard, but all it comes back to be able to talk about it and sort of nudge your way into a different way of being when you're in the trigger. You can even ask, in that situation, so once again, in that moment, it depends on what you've previously decided in terms of whether you'd say something or not, because that could end in an argument, couldn't it? You know, you'd flag it with them, but hey, I think we need to talk about this later because that didn't feel good for me when this happened, you know, so you'd flag it with them. And then you would have to kind of see it as a pattern that you're working on together for your partner to also think about his commitment to you and what his, you know, loyalties are to you and how he's prioritizing your relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and exactly right. And then what can happen sometimes if you're a partner of a self-sacrificer, sometimes you can hear them, you cop all the resentment and the whinging, like, oh, I'm so tired because I've done this. And you think, well, I'm just listening to your self-inflicted whinging. Oh, really? Like, you
know, no, it's true. I'm sorry. Like, you know, it's true.
You know, you could cop the brunt of it. So it depends how strong the schema is, of course, and how he's coping with it. But if he's certainly got no insight and he's surrendering to it all the time, it can be a nightmare for the partner. But it's not an impossible schema to work with. It's actually a schema that you can change reasonably well and reduce the intensity of reasonably well. You can find the origin of that schema and the function of it. And people need to be firstly really aware of, okay, what's the secondary gain I get from having a strong self-sacrifice schema? What about all this resentment in me or the discomfort in my body that's building up and my fatigue and my exhaustion that I've got? And often the family cops the brunt of that. Yeah. So I'd say to him, Karen, it's okay that you have this self-sacrifice schema, but it's kind of the self-sacrifice schema is a fascinating one because,
isn't it?
You know, people can get very attached to having that with pride.
The joke you made actually can be a manifestation of the schema. So if they are, you know, so say they're surrendering and they think they in a relationship with you, they have to sacrifice all their needs. And so they're going out of their way to kind of make you happy all the time. But unbeknownst to you, they're building up this bank of resentment.
Towards you. Yeah.
That sometimes then explodes and you go, what? Where did that come from?
I didn't see that coming. Yeah.
Correct. And sometimes it's like the person abruptly ends the relationship as well. Didn't see it coming because this scheme has been operating unbeknownst to you and they've been feeling more and more resentful and burnt out. So I suppose it all depends on how it's manifesting for you because, I mean, that's something you have to discuss with him because it's usually pretty obvious too, isn't it, when someone's doing that? Yeah. Like they're going over the top to make your life easy or to think of you all the time. And it can feel a bit uncomfortable.
If you're on the receiving end of a partner who is very self-sacrificing. Yes. And depending on your own schemas, you could take advantage of that to your own benefit.
It but really very the, good.
The big challenge for someone who's got a self-sacrifice schema and an unchecked, unhealed self-sacrifice schema is to just be really shifting the focus onto what's going on for them and what are their needs and are they meeting them or not and how they feel when they're constantly suppressing their own needs in favor of someone else and just start to think about it. That's the challenge, isn't it, to be able to sort of tolerate perhaps being in someone's bad books just because you're actually doing something that's might be useful for you.
Mm.
Tolerating the discomfort of the guilt, feeling guilty because you're not able to be the knight in shining armor for everybody or whatever it might be, whatever the story is.
That's right.
We should do a podcast on therapist schemas and our observation over the years of doing supervision with therapists and therapy with therapists, huh?
So that obviously the self-sacrifice schema came into your mind for that reason.
Yeah. And different permutations of it.
Yes. Yeah, that would be interesting.
There's a lot of wounded healers out there in all sorts of different professions, mental health professions and others. But, yeah, it is a fascinating schema. You know, I personally clinically see it very related to subjugation, even though they're very different schemas and they have different functions. They are highly correlated.
Yeah,
but sometimes subjugation is the hidden, like the evil twin of the self-sacrificer because they don't want to admit they actually have a subjugation schema as well, you know, because somehow that's negative, whereas a self-sacrifice schema is like, oh, I've got the self-sacrifice schema. You know,
I'm a good person.
I'm a good person.
Mm.
Yeah, but yes, there's actually a hell of a lot of unrecognized subjugation in women in the helping professions, that one out there.
Yeah.
We should probably explore that.
We'll flag it.
A bit more detail. Mm. Yeah, anything else for Karen or that pretty much wraps it up?
I think that wraps it up.
We went on a bit of a tangent, Karen.
But we did.
Hopefully there's some takeaways in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose we would always say make sure your own house is in order, i.e. be doing your own self-development because that just makes life easier. It just gives you a whole other way of problem solving when you know what your own schemas are and you're working on yourself. So I think both of these scenarios, that's necessary.
Absolutely. And then for Karen, another thing I just thought of was, you know, it's actually not everyone actively seeks out therapy to work on themselves.
Mm.
So the fact that your partner, Karen, is doing that, you know, he should be, you know, that's a good move. That's very positive. And also your own as well. And then by looking at your schemas and noticing, you know, why do I act the way I do? Why are we having the same old argument? It can be really transformative, can't it? You know, it can really shed a great light on the unknown. We're just sort of shining the light on stuff that we didn't know what was going on, didn't have a name for it. But when you start to put names on things and look at, okay, that's my schema, and when that's triggered by these stuff, this is how I feel like responding, and then I typically respond in these ways. Just to have that sequence of understanding is so useful, so helpful.
It really is. Makes sense. You feel more powerful because you're not waiting for someone else to change or hoping they're going to. You're able to
do that yourself. Absolutely. Because, I mean, often we can change dynamics in relationships by starting to work on ourselves, even if the other person isn't ready.
That's right.
Yeah. So if you want to get in, I think that was a pretty good episode. I'm happy with that. So Thank you. If you're still listening to us, thanks for tuning in. We know that you could be listening to any old podcast, but you chose to listen to us. So we really appreciate that, don't we, Justine?
Yeah, it's really nice. It's nice to know that people are interested in schemas and are getting benefit from us talking things through in that way, because we're very passionate about it, obviously.
Yeah, so we really value and appreciate your feedback and some of your really lovely emails. Mm. They've been really touching and very, very encouraging. And so if you want to get in touch with us, don't forget to check out our website, which is goodmood.com.au, and you can send us an email at justineandgemma@goodmood.com.au. Mm-hmm. We've got some things that we're working on that we're going to keep you in the loop. So stay tuned. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks
we'll see
for
you
listening.
Next time. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks so much for listening today. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd love for you to share it with others. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast to get notifications when new shows are released. You can visit us at goodmood.com.au/podcast for more information. You know, this podcast is intended for learning and entertainment purposes, and we really hope it achieves that. But because it's not a substitute for personal therapy, we'd like you to consult a qualified mental health professional for tailored support. Bye for now.